which to the ignorant are the greatest reality. The objective focusing of attention upon matter. The moment that you bestow everything you have to the external world rises as a magnificent image. The moment you dismiss this image by detachment, it disappears. So the yogin also points out, whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not, whether you want to accept it or not, this is exactly what happens when you die. For when you die, you do not have the experience of the world and you departing from it. It is the world that departs. Suddenly, this whole mysterious pageantry simply evaporates, and you are exactly the same, and you're watching a world disappear. The reason being, your own center of consciousness has shifted. And where it has shifted, a new world appears. Where it is removed, the old world disappears. For all these things are nothing but emphases. It is quite conceivable, in fact, some of our university professors today are quite certain it is true, that if man could shift consciousness about through a series of tuning ins and tuning outs, he might discover 100 different civilizations right here at the same time, that this very space around us is filled with other kinds of life, just as real as our own, but not existing to us because we do not tune it in. So that tuning in makes it real. Tuning out causes it to disappear. But anything that can be tuned in or tuned out is not inevitably true. It cannot be completely so. It is a relative thing. And in this relationship of tuning in and tuning out, the only reality conceivable is the radiant spark that does it. This spark, then, knows itself to continue in the midst of everything else that is changing. So a little later, the Vedantist, or the yogin, having disintegrated, so to say, the material world, so far as he is concerned, he'll come back to it in due course. But for the moment, he is a spark in space. A spark, perhaps, that is tremendously thrilled. This new experience suddenly causes almost an ecstasy within the self. The individual liberated from this little tiny cocoon, which we call a body, suddenly feels the presence of infinite things. It thrills to the music of the spheres. It thrills to the infinite diversity of sidereal color. It is picked up in a strange dance of life. And the being says to itself, "At last, I'm beginning to experience something of these vast realities. And I now discover that I live in a world of light and color and feeling and beauty, of motion, of art, of music, of everything you can think of." And then slowly in the meditation, the yogin works his way through this mysterious enchantment. For this other enchantment is also part of a world through which he must pass. It is the magic garden of desires, a fulfillment of desires. It is a magic garden in which the individual says, "If I can only be happy, everything is well." But this isn't the answer either, because wherever happiness exists, unhappiness must also ultimately come in. As Omar says, "The Lord with paradise devised the snake." That always has to be there. So gradually this wonderful world of feeling goes to sleep also. And the yogin suddenly discovers that he has no longer any moods, any feelings. He does not know or care whether he ever has joy again or not. His emotions go to sleep in some kind of a strange rational certainty. He begins to experience this pure mentation, the mentation of everything being sufficient because it is so, because it is true, because it is real. the mentation which experiences all things in terms of logic and a pure reason, a reason far above anything that we know in this world, a reason which seems to reach out for the first time to the total understanding of existence. And this little spark is still there. This little spark that is going to understand all things and experiences more and more within itself the strange unfoldment of an infinite wisdom, a wisdom that gives comprehension of all things. And still the yogin is fighting his way. He thinks, some might think he has arrived, but he knows he has not. That as long as he remains as an observer, as long as there is some kind of a boundary between himself and that which is to be understood, he is not quite there. No matter how much he knows, how much he observes, he is still an observer. No matter how much he contemplates, there is still himself and that which he contemplates. There is still this mysterious interval of total experience which he has not passed. So finally in samadhi, the yogin voluntarily relinquishes the self that is the seeker. He not only relinquishes his desire to know, he relinquishes his need to know. He relinquishes his instinctive right to know. He relinquishes his mental satisfaction in knowing. He is striving to get past this polarized existence. He is looking for the only answer, which is the final end of conflict. To end conflict, he must destroy the interval between me and thee. He must overwhelm the interval between himself and God. He must also break through that mysterious wall that divides relative error from absolute truth. He has to get through there some way. There's only one way he can do it, and that is to allow the self, which is the divider, to go to sleep, so that gradually he must take this supreme step of absolute faith. He must relinquish his own right to exist. He must lose his life in God if he is to save his life. Jesus said, "Who loses his life for my sake shall have life everlasting." And it is this voluntary relinquishing of self-existence that suddenly causes the individual to escape totally from polarized consciousness. Now you might say, yes, but when the individual has made this relinquishment, he has then lost, ultimately, all control over his own destiny. This is not true in samadhi. It may be true in the Buddhist Mahaparinirvana, for that is the road of no return. But in the samadhi, the individual, the yogin, experiences the sleep of truth. Now, in sleep, we lose control. We forget we exist. We have no self-existence. And yet, in the morning, we awake. Therefore, the loss of self-consciousness is not proof, per se, of loss of existence. A very important point in Buddhism. It is not necessary for man to experience himself in order to exist. Sleep proves this in a very simple way. Sleep proves that existence continues, that self-existence is merely an interrupted process within the substance of a total existence. Samadhi, therefore, is the rejection or the relinquishing of self-existence by yoga. The individual thereby becoming one with existence. From this experience, there is, however, a certain difference with sleep. Because sleep, of course, is a natural phenomenon due to exhaustion, and natural cycles of rehabilitation. We cannot carry the analogy too far. But in the case of absolute samadhi, the individual has a dimension of experience which cannot be defined here. He exists without self-existence. He is in a unified condition with absolute knowledge and absolute being, without a sense of his own personal consciousness. He is no longer an observer. He is no longer something accepting or receiving into himself. He is diffused in the very essence of absolute unification. He has achieved the true meaning of yoga, which is union. He is one with the beloved, as the Muslim mystic would say. So he discovers in this truth. He discovers, as the old school of Cairo, the great Egyptian Muslim mystic school, realized, that beyond all knowing is the mysterious and dramatic truth that all knowing is a kind of genteel lunacy. That the only thing that is real is this state that transcends knowing and divides polarized existence from total life. If this is difficult to attain, it is almost equally difficult to describe. Those who have attempted to describe it have simply fallen back upon the concept of a great infinite peace, an ocean of serenity, an end of all doubt and all fear and all emergency, a timelessness, a rest full of action, a dynamic suspension of effort, a Zen type of thing. Not that the individual simply passes into a state of infinite reward, as in some heaven, or into the nothingness which is the atheist's hope. It is rather that the individual becomes one with an ever-moving, ever-growing, ever-unfolding eternity. But there is no longer any actual separateness. And the entity remains in this state for a time. But in the samadhi problem, this time is rhythmic. A man finds that as he has not yet fully attained this condition, that he is not able to fully maintain it. That is the cyclic law that brings him back. Because it is not his true state. He may achieve it temporarily, but having lost, in the highest phase of samadhi, self-directive, he suddenly can no longer press on to the maintenance of this state. He therefore experiences it and slips back again into objectivity. He drops back again into mental awareness, then into emotional awareness, then into physical reawareness, and awakens from his meditation. He has sort of gone on a space ship through conditions as far as the fuel would take him, and then the fuel having failed, he drops back again. He cannot stay there because he is not able to perpetually maintain his attitude, the attitude not being as yet fully his nature. But out of this experience, which saints and mystics have recorded in many countries and under many situations, there comes the psychic background for man's realization or belief that truth is unpolarized. That actually the realities we seek are complete unities, complete wholenesses. And that all mental processes which polarize do separate man from truth. We have overworked the physical sensations to bind us to materiality. We have overworked the emotional sensations binding us to the gratification of appetites. We have overworked the intellectual faculties, binding ourselves to a universe of intellectual, educational, industrial, economic achievements. We have assumed that each of these ends was the answer. We have assumed that with our intellect we can storm the gates of heaven, that we can think our way to everlasting glory, and we cannot, because the mind will always be polarized, will always be immersed in the ignorance around itself and within itself. You have to transcend the faculties. And the highest kind of wisdom that we can know in this world is that which comes from ages of experience, by which we come to learn in the end that wisdom is not in this world. This is that type of point that we made in the beginning, that the beginning of wisdom is always in the recognition of ignorance. The recognition of the fact that we are wrong must always be the beginning of the realization that we are right. It is always by this reverse procedure. So in this world, we have truth and error. We have error, which is nothing more or less than an inadequate degree of truth. We have truth as we know it in this world, which is simply a gradual recovery from a condition of discomforting error. We have truths and errors that change and twist and turn with every facet of human life and growth. We have discoveries that make the truths of one generation the errors of another. It goes on and on and on. But always it is polarized. Always it is the result of a duality of procedures. Somewhere we have to break through this. We have to recognize various patterns the ancients discovered. The pattern of spirit and matter, each only an aspect of the other. That actually there is only one substance, and that polarization arises in it, not in itself essentially, but in man's effort to interpret it. We have no proof whatever that the gnat in the sunbeam is any less in the cosmos than a planet or a sun. We do not know this, we only assume it. We also realize that good and evil are not at all clearly marked as we think they are. That good may be the least degree of evil. Evil, the least degree of good. We never have any realization of how these policies operate. But we are convinced that the so-called opposites are by degrees, that the Gnostics were correct in their theory of emanationism, in which superior forces moving downward in emanating arcs, meeting inferior forces ascending in emanating arcs, created constant compounds of reality and illusion. And that in these various compounds, one band emerges from man and the other radiates from heaven. Man is ever in some kind of an adjustment, therefore, between himself and that which is superior to himself. So if you want to try to make some kind of a little practical program out of this and get it out of the sky entirely and down into your own particular problems, you may ask yourself, what is the truth about some of the common things with which you are constantly working? What is the truth, for example, in the relationships between yourselves and other people? A very common problem. You may say, I have a son. He's my boy. I'm mighty proud of him. The first problem is he your boy? From a physical standpoint, yes. And according to physical laws, he is your son. But the moment you press this so-called truth too far, it leads to a dangerous error. The moment you think of a person as your son, it is very difficult not to take an authoritarian attitude toward that person. If it's yours, it is your right to use as you please. If it's yours, you have the right to control it, the right to create its destiny for it. If it's yours, you have the right to say what profession it will follow, what art or craft it will follow, who it will marry, where it will live, what it will do with its money. These are all your rights if it is yours. But the moment you begin to live with this, you realize you don't have those rights. If you force those rights, you will destroy your son. You will change him into something that neither you nor anyone else could be proud of. But after that boy is yours for a while, you discover that a selfness is arising in that son. That ultimately this son is going to belong to himself and not to you. So the truth that you started with, that it was your boy, slowly changes. And you have to face the ultimate fact that the boy belongs to himself. What is your relation to this boy then? According to body, you help to create that body. According to the person in the body, you are not the father of that person. That person belongs to itself, just as you belong to yourself, and as your father belonged to himself. Thus, this idea that children are simply the progeny of their parents, while it is apparently justifiable biologically, falls apart completely psychologically. So here's a half-truth. Here's a partial truth. When the child is a month old, it isn't old enough to bring your truth into question. Therefore, your truth stands. When it is 10 years old, your truth still stands in part, but it is weakening. And by the time he is 20 years old, your truth begins to fall apart. Therefore, why not find out what the truth of the matter was in the first place? The truth of the matter is exactly as Buddha would have pointed out. This child is not your son, and at the same time, this child is not your son, because it depends upon the time, the situation, the condition. Under certain situations, at certain times, it is your son. If this boy is injured, even though he may be a man of 40 years old, your sorrow, your consolation, your help goes out to him. He is still your son. If this boy, however, goes his own way and succeeds and has his own life and never needs you, he is your son, but he is not your son. He is still of your blood. But unless he calls upon your parenthood, the relationship of the father and son gets very thin and finally disappears entirely in the maturity of things. So the real matter is that always and forever, father and son are united in something else, life. In a mysterious way, father and son are one being. But in that one being are all fathers and all sons. So that actually all that lives is one being, taking an infinite diversity of manifested relationships. The stranger and the enemy and the friend and the son are all relationships set up by conditions in life. But all of these different persons arise from one. In substance, they are one. Consequently, there can be nothing but identity at the source of life. All other relationships are passing. To realize the identity is to meet all the needs. To accept any of the relationships without recognizing the identity is to shortchange something. Therefore, the son who is yours at the same time belongs to himself. But the himself to which he belongs and the yourself to which you belong are two manifestations of one eternal self to which we all belong. But if we do not get that higher point clear, all of our secondary relationships fall apart. The polarized selves below are in trouble and conflict forever, unless the unpolarized over-self, the Atman, is recognized as the basis of all true relationship. All relationship is actually identity. All things are one thing. Within this identity, we can then set up any other relationships we want to, and they will always be compatible. But without the realization of the over-identity, all other relationships become illusionary. So illusionary relationships are those in which facts are explained incorrectly, or in which the wrong evidence is used to prove the right thing. The man says, I and my son, in a sense, we are one person. We understand each other. He is my blood. He is the continuance of myself into the future. This is fine as far as it goes, but it can lead to the most selfish possessiveness the world has ever known. Because in this there is no true insight. But if this man can realize that actually he and his son are two eternal manifestations of eternal being, then all the other relationships become the basis of fair, friendly understanding. It's the same point again with the Indic theory of family. In this country, a mother will say, I have given everything to my children, therefore it is now their duty to take care of me. This is a perfectly reasonable interpretation of the ancient Mosaic code. But it was also a very learned rabbi of Talmudic virtues who on one occasion pointed out that it is more difficult for 12 sons to take care of one mother than it is for one mother to raise 12 sons. There is this difference. In India, the situation is reversed. The mother says, when I have raised my sons, I have paid my debt to my mother. It goes back instead of forward. In other words, the child is always the fulfillment of the duty to pay for our own upbringing. The child is therefore allowed to be free, in a sense, because we have paid our debt by bringing this child up. It is not the child who has contracted a debt. It is the parent who has paid a debt. But let the child remember, when it has a child, that the same rule will apply. But the difference is psychological, and yet these are two interpretations of one obvious fact. Which is the illusion? Which is the reality? How are we going to judge all of these differences? The real fact of it, of course, lies again behind. Namely, that the universe is infinite growth. Therefore, all things have the common responsibility of growing. If man lived only once and was brought into this life only as the result of the attitudes of parents, then perhaps the parent would be fully responsible. But actually, we are part of an eternal generating process. And philosophy and Oriental thinking says, factually, there is no responsibility. There is no duty. But there is an all-enclosing graciousness. There is always the wonderful privilege of helping to bring life into life. These things are not duties. They are the gracious ways in which we share together those who brought us into the world, those we bring into the world. It is a wonderful comradeship of purposes. Nobody owns anybody. Nobody needs to. There is only one owner, and that is the master of the show, that which is behind it all, the eternal power. And all things that grow, generate, build, are merely manifesting this divine power. It is the gracious possibility of life, therefore, to fulfill the natural laws of its creator. Not because it has to, although maybe it does, but not because it has to feel that it has to. Rather than that it should feel that through fulfillment it worships. Through the doing of gracious and beautiful things, it glorifies the graciousness and beauty which sustains existence. These patterns, therefore, pull together, always hunting for unity, always seeking for the basic principle that is so big that it takes all the conflict out of secondary principles and enables us to restore them to their proper honor. Now, we may not be correct entirely in all of our unities. We're not absolutely sure of some of these things. But one thing we are relatively certain, namely that we are advancing in the right direction when we remove destructive polarities. Whenever we find a source of understanding, we have grown. Whenever we create a source of misunderstanding, we have retrograded. Whatever is the result of our decision, we have a better world. We are moving in the right direction. We may not be at the final decision. Perhaps there are understandings far beyond us. But that which overcomes dualities by putting a sovereign unity above them, this is the next step toward knowing, toward the fulfillment of knowing. This is better than what we knew before. This was better than the previous standard by which we lived. We also have the power to know that truth, whatever truth degree we possess, helps something. Truth will never cause things to become worse. Truth may discomfort us, but it will only be our selfishness that is discomforted. Wherever a truth is practiced, there is a certain strength resulting from it, a security, a betterment for all value. Wherever an illusion is practiced, something must go wrong. There is a loss of ground. There is a rise of differences. For wherever an error comes into existence, there is a loss of insight. Wherever we make a mistake, a prejudice raises its head. Wherever we use the best virtue that we possess, a freedom is achieved from prejudice or deceit or conceit or whatever may be the difficult factor. By watching this alone, we can gradually guide our way in the direction of greater realizations. Always they produce a better fruit. Always they lead to a happier ending. Now, in the world today, we have tremendous conflicts, more than ever before in history. And many persons have got to work out these conflicts some way within themselves or be torn to pieces by their own tensions and stress. Tension is simply conflict. Tension is polarized energy fighting with itself. Pressure is reality and unreality locked in some kind of a situation in which actually reality is simply present and unreality is fighting this presence. Reality never fights anything, but unreality is always fighting. Reality does not need to fight. Truth can never be assailed successfully, therefore it never need to be defended. It may need only to be achieved, to be accomplished as an experience within life. Everywhere these tensions arise, it's because the individual is living better in one area and worse in another. He sees a certain amount which leads him on to a higher way of life. He is trying desperately, however, to overlook some kind of a quality of character that is good in order that he may accommodate some character of quality that is not good. So the individual who knows in his own heart and soul that he should be temperate drinks too much. Not because he does not know better, but because he lacks the courage to do that which he knows. He is finding constant excuses to perpetuate his error. Another individual knows in his heart that his religion calls for peaceful understanding of other people. Yet he cannot achieve this. He is constantly, subjectively, instinctively combating. These are his polarities, and they are tearing him to pieces. This is the thing that has torn Christendom apart for nearly 20 centuries. Jesus left his admonition to his disciples, "If ye love me, love one another." This was the doctrine, but men could not live it. They could not love one another. It demanded something they could not provide. Because if you love another person, you can't cheat them. And cheating is very profitable. If you love people, you must be kind, and people feel like being unkind. So little by little, the great doctrine dropped back to become a conscience mechanism. The doctrine which actually is very near to a great truth, nearer to a universal reality, love ye one another. This became subjectified, along with many other beautiful concepts, along with the Ten Commandments, along with the Code of Justinian, all the great systems of moral instruction, along with the Institutes of Manu, the great Hindu Book of the Law. All of these great code revelations were just too much for the individual who still wanted to nurse his littleness. And after having nursed his littleness for a long time, he discovers tension. The tension is life within him, an eternal life, a good life, trying to manifest through something that wants to misrepresent it morning, noon, and night. Whenever this life forms a beautiful reality in us, we begin to cut this reality down to shape. We begin to try to distort it until it fits some little purpose of our own. We go to all kinds of procedures. We legislate and we create groups of people who are going to all agree that a certain right is wrong. We're going to do anything, but we cannot defeat this mysterious vibratory rate in ourselves, the rate which is ourselves, the rate of harmony, of peace. Inside of us is something the vibration of which is peace. Perhaps the vibration itself is truth. But whatever it is, it cannot be refused. And this vibration moving out against our self-centeredness turns the life of the average person into a battlefield in which the good in him, which by its own radiance is a light that is there, nothing can be done about it. It is there. It cannot be taken away. But around this light, man builds all kinds of distorting structures. The light breaks through these structures, and as it breaks through, the individual is hurt. The light suddenly casts itself into some dark area of conduct, revealing the facts, and the individual is hurt. Everywhere this struggle, therefore, between truth and error, between reality and illusion, is the struggle between life and mind, emotion, body resisting life. Mind says, "I will interpret life as I please, and it better be what I say it is." So life remains exactly what it is and beats the mind. Emotions say, I'm taking life, I'm going to make life do what I want it to. I shall use life to fulfill desire. Life takes over this emotional pattern and punishes it, because the pattern is wrong. The pattern cannot sustain itself. Life will never do what this pattern requires. Therefore, the person is miserable. The body says, I will do as I please. I will break all the natural rules of health. I will take the energy which has been given to me, and I will waste this energy. But I still demand the right to be healthy. Nature, with its energy and its life, cannot be touched by these demands. Life fulfills its purpose. Body is broken if it opposes life. So everywhere, the error is the individual breaking faith with life, law, pattern, truth. And this breaking of faith creates a separateness, isolates the person from the universal. Only when the person acknowledges error, returns to the universal, and establishes itself in the eternal nature, can unity be reestablished. God has not departed from man. Man attempted to depart from God, but could not do it. For every part of man is also God. Therefore, man, in his willfulness, tried to establish his own empire in a universal empire. He became a small, discontented minority. He became a kind of universal beatnik. And as a result, he's in trouble. He has to go back to the rules. The polarities he has set up have no existence except within his own confusion. For he has found there are two ways of doing things wrong. These are the polarities. And only one way of doing them right, and that is equilibrium. And he has found that the only way in which he can reconcile himself with the infinite is through the realization or restatement of the experience of unity, in which there is no longer polarized consciousness. This was the burden of Zen. This is the teaching of the Sufis. This was the instinctive realization of the Quakers and the Friends. It has also been the mystical revelation that has guided the saints and sages since the dawn of time. Consequently, we are seeking still to bring all polarized opposites into complete and perfect equilibrium. For the moment we achieve equilibrium, in that moment of absolute balance, reality moves in, takes over, and we are no longer subjected to this endless war between light and darkness. Reality alone is real. Light and darkness are its moods, but they are held within the pattern of its righteousness. Man, not aware of the pattern, struggles to overcome the polarizations. Without any realization that these polarizations do not need to be overcome as we would do it. They merely need to be realized through. The facts to be seen. And the one, or the nearest thing to the infinite state of being that we can know, must be elevated above becoming. Becoming is all we know, but becoming takes place in being. While becoming is a struggle forever, we suffer. While becoming is recognized as a natural manifestation of being, being itself present in all of its own becoming, then we flow with life, flow with Tao, have a natural and gracious adjustment and a non-competitive relationship with each other and with the power that created us. Well, I think our time is up for this evening, so we'll try next week.